where we've come in the discussion of the state, the capital state so far, is to begin by a set of observations about the state, that the state tends to serve the interests of the capitalist class, that the form of the state helps to explain why this is so. It's not just the manipulation of the state by capitalists, but the very form of the state helps it to serve the interests of the capitalist class. It does this through negative selectivity. That's the way we've theorized how this process works. And that this negative selectivity has a distinctive class character. And all of this, then, is bound up with seeing the state as actually fulfilling certain kinds of functions for capitalism. The state reproduces capitalism through these kinds of properties. The weakness in this argument, the part that we haven't really discussed much, is the problem of what in functionalist discussions is called the feedback problem. That is, how does it come to pass that the state actually comes to fulfill these functions? Why is it designed in such a way as to do all these things? How does it come to pass that it has these functional properties? In the Darwinian case, in the case of biology, we have a pretty good theory of that. Natural selection through adaptation is the process by which the functional attributes of animals are selected over time. But how do these functional properties of states, how are they selected over time? Basically, I think this is where the functional analysis of capitalism of the capitalist state has to be combined with an historical analysis of social struggles and their contradictions. The functionality of the state is always only partially achieved, and it's achieved primarily through processes of struggle and contestation, rather than through some automatic process that operates behind the backs of actors in the manner that natural selection occurs. I think the functionality, the explanation of the functionality of the state, this is on page 2 of the notes, has to include 3 primary elements. This is how you would develop an account of the functionality and how it emerges. You need an account of political class struggle, an account that could be called institutional learning, an account of the systemic pressures which make certain solutions stable and others precarious. The struggle arguments say that at certain historical moments, there are particular periods or moments in which the institutional organization of the state is an object of struggle. There are moments in which these attributes of the state are themselves being contested. And the victories and defeats that occur at those moments of struggle determine how effective these institutional devices are. This is where these filter mechanisms, these negative selectivities and so forth, are actually created. They are created through processes of struggle in which there are victories and defeats and compromises and mishmashes. A lot of it can be quite haphazard. And when the dust settles, you have varying degrees of effective institutionalization of these class principles. The second kind of process is learning. In many instances, people really are pretty clueless. You know, they have theories and ideologies which tell them what kind of state will best serve their interests. And they engage in struggles, and they win victories, and they institute these devices. But often there's going to be mistakes. Things aren't going to work out the way people anticipated. This is particularly true for policies, but it's also true for the design of rules of the game. Remember, we have these 3 levels of contestation, of struggle over the game itself, over rules of the game, and over plays of the game. Well, in each case, there's going to be mistakes, and a lot of institution building and modification occurs through a trial and error process. This is where there is a crucial role for things like policy experts, think tanks, universities, all sorts of ways in which the learning capacity of key actors in the state can be enhanced or reduced, which allows for mistakes to be corrected, since inevitably mistakes will be made. So a second aspect of the account of the functionality of the state needs to be an account of the learning mechanisms, how mistakes are corrected, and how institutional designs get modified over time in light of those mistakes. And the third aspect is what I refer to as systemic pressures or system reproducing tendencies. The learning process occurs in a context in which what does and doesn't work depends heavily on the nature of capitalism itself. What kinds of policies will or will not stabilize capitalism depend very much on the changes in the character of capitalism itself. The kinds of policies which help stabilize and reproduce capitalism in the 1930s are not the same as the kinds of policies which stabilize and reproduce capitalism in the 50s or today. Some institutional solutions are vulnerable because they precipitate disinvestment and fail to smooth market problems. So some kinds of solutions which get tried turn out to be mistakes precisely because of the way they destabilize capitalism. And that generates pressures for change. So the trial and error process by which learning takes place occurs against a background of the system dynamics of capitalism itself and how that changes. Functional solutions and stable relations, therefore, emerge to the extent that they do emerge through the interplay of struggles, learning, and systemic pressures. Now, there is a fantasy, I think, which both, so to speak, I call this the bourgeois political fantasy, but it's also a fantasy of economists and political scientists, a little bit less of sociologists. It's the fantasy that you could solve these problems once and for all and if you could only create the perfect design of our institutions, then they would be just self-perpetuating, that there would be some kind of stable institutional profile which would perfectly reproduce capitalism without the necessity of repeated re-scrambling and transformation. That seems to me a fantasy. I don't believe there is any such thing as a stable equilibrium of institutional forms. It's one of the reasons why a capitalist democracy is probably a better institutional structure for capitalists than more authoritarian forms of capitalism in general, because it has greater capacity for transformation in the light of structural problems. Precisely what a liberal democracy does is create a space for institutional transformations in ways that make the system more adaptive over time, rather than rigidly fixed and unresponsive to the sorts of changes that occur. But that's not necessarily the case. Liberal democracies can also create extremely cumbersome mechanisms for change, and some authoritarian systems have turned out to be quite adept at changing institutional forms in light of new necessities. All of this gets more complicated because of a series of processes which tend to produce systematically, as opposed to just haphazardly, contradictions in the functioning of the state. So we focused mostly on how to think about its functionality so far, but there are also, I think, systematic reasons for this functionality to break down. I refer to this as contradictory functionality. And there are four types of contradictory functionality, which I think have dominated the discussions of this problem. And I will very briefly just describe each of these. I always say, you're going to get tired of this kind of excuse making on my part. I always say I'm going to be very brief and then I go on. Now this is partially, of course, you have some responsibility here. You need to interrupt me and ask questions and not just let me ramble on going through the notes which are available to you anyway. Four types of contradictory functionality. First type. This is the situation in which the state has multiple functions. There are multiple things it needs to do to stabilize capitalism. But the different things it needs to do to stabilize and reproduce capitalism undermine each other. You have a situation where you have what I would call contradictions between state functions. The example of this contradiction between state functions that has most often been cited is the contradiction between the legitimation and accumulation function of the state. This was a central theme in discussions of crisis and the relationship of economic crisis to the state in the 1970s. There was a very influential book called The Fiscal Crisis of the State by James O'Connor, written in the early 1970s, which is actually still a very relevant book. I think its central arguments apply to the kinds of pressures on state budgets which we observe today. His central argument was that there was an inherent tendency for there to be a contradiction between two imperatives that the capitalist state faced, two functional requirements it needed to fulfill, two different ways it needed to reproduce capitalism. One is the state needs to create legitimacy, that is, it needs to engage in interventions which the broad public will see as legitimate, and which they will all not just see that the state interventions are legitimate, but which will lead them to see capitalism as legitimate. Capitalism imposes lots of deprivations in the lives of people. The deprivations which people experience could lead them to object to capitalism, make them critical of capitalism, make them more oppositional to capitalism. The state provides a way of softening these risks, especially through various insurance functions that the state fulfills. And in so doing, it reduces the potential for political disruption. That's what's called the legitimation function of the state. Right, so the legitimation function of the state occurs when the state helps to reduce the risks that the risk exposure of ordinary people to the ups and downs of capitalism. By reducing that risk exposure, people find capitalism a more acceptable form of society, because although it does create uncertainty and risks, they're partially insulated from it. Social security of various forms would be the paradigm example of the state intervening in ways which reduce risks, and by reducing risks make the system as a whole more legitimate, both the political system and the economic system. The problem that O'Connor identifies is that initially when the state engages in an intervention of this sort, Social Security, initially people see this as enhancing the legitimacy of the system. But eventually it becomes normalized, seen as simply as a right, as an entitlement. And therefore it becomes very difficult to reduce. It has a ratchet-like character. Once you expand these insurance functions, they're very difficult to roll back. Spending over these kinds of social well-being and risk reduction processes tends to be sticky downwards. It's easier to expand entitlements than to reduce them. And this creates a potential contradiction between the legitimation and accumulation function of the state when the accumulation function, that is the way the state directly supports capital accumulation, might require the state to reduce such entitlements. In the 1970s, when this initial argument was laid out, no one imagined that the state would actually be able to roll back the social entitlements that had been gained over the previous 30 or 40 years. This was seen as posing a major problem for the state, that risks have been, to a significant extent, muted through social insurance of various sorts. And the idea that the state could engage in some major attack and rollback of these did not seem plausible. But of course, that's what happened, at least to some extent, in the 1980s and into the 90s through the neoliberal assault on the state. So this particular contradiction, while it was a contradiction, it turned out there were political ways of dealing with it that people at the time that O'Connor was writing didn't think was possible. There are basically then, I think, two weaknesses with this argument about the contradiction between legitimation and accumulation. The first is the accumulation function itself can be legitimating, so that's not as deep a contradiction as O'Connor might have thought. That is, to the extent that the state is successful in fostering accumulation, and you get a robust and dynamic capital accumulation process, that itself adds to the legitimacy of the system. So instead of seeing that the task of legitimation and the task of accumulation as working against each other, in fact, the state supporting accumulation can itself contribute to legitimation. And the second problem, which I've already mentioned, is that when there is a tension between the two, when legitimation does undermine accumulation, it turns out to be politically less difficult than we thought in the 1970s for the state to be part of a counterattack on the legitimation function itself under the ideological rubric of, for example, neoliberalism. Right, that's the first type of problematic functionality, is where different functions of the state undermine each other. A second source of contradiction centers around the problem of the kind of autonomy of the state needed for it to effectively perform its desirable functions for capital, and the way in which that autonomy may undermine the effectiveness of the state's subordination to capital. This is the heart of Offey's argument in his paper on the crisis of crisis management. The argument can be summarized in the following theses. Capitalism has self-destructive tendencies. If capitalism is just left to itself, it will destroy itself. The anarchy of the market produces crises, and these crises, unless they are regulated and flanked by the state, will destroy capitalism. The state must intervene to prevent capitalism from destroying itself economically. That's the first thesis. The second thesis is, the deeper are these kinds of contradictions, the more autonomy the state needs for manipulation by particularistic interests of particular capitalists in order for it to intervene in the right way. That is, in order for the state to effectively protect capitalism from itself, it has to avoid being directly manipulated by particular capitalist interests. If it's directly manipulated by particular capitalist interests, it can't act effectively in the interests of capitalism as a whole. The state needs autonomy from particular manipulations if it is to be effective as a regulator of capitalism as a whole. Yeah.
Does that mean that there's a constant site of struggle within capitalism between, on the one hand, certain very powerful individuals or collectivities who are trying to take direct control of the whole system, and on the other hand, the rest of the working class who's trying to preserve its more pluralistic character?
The way you just framed it, you said powerful capitalist interests against the rest of the working class.
Well, if there's an individual or a group of individuals who get so powerful that they threaten to impose their particularistic interests over the whole system, if that's against the interests of capitalists as a whole, so I'm saying that there might be very powerful particular members of the ruling class. That's what I took you to be saying.
Yeah, right. But you said, you said capitalists and other workers.
I meant other capitalists.
Okay, that's what I wasn't. That was the. I think there's a. It doesn't necessarily take the form of a few powerful capitalists being at odds with the capitalist class as a whole. It can be all capitalists can act in particularistic ways. They're all simply trying to get a piece of the action to manipulate particular agencies to have their interests advanced, not worrying about the conditions of reproduction of the system as a whole. So it's not necessarily the case that you have, on the one hand, a few rogue capitalists who are trying to control the state for their interests, and all other capitalists who are sensible and wanting to have a... That would not be the typical characteristic. The typical context for this is you have a state which is not effectively insulated from manipulation, so all sorts of different particularistic groups of capitalists are influencing different parts of the state to protect their particular interests, and nobody's watching the store as a whole. The state doesn't have the autonomy to do that. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen because if there is going to be action to protect the interests of capital as a whole, it's not going to come from capitalists. It's going to come from the state. But the state needs autonomy from capitalists in order to act that way. A vulnerable state is one which gets colonized by different parts of capital. It doesn't mean that there's any one group of capitalists that are controlling the whole system. No, they don't. That's not what they're doing. They're just controlling their piece of the action. They're colonizing particular bureaucracies, particular agencies, particular groups of politicians. Yeah.
So what you mean by particularistic interest is could you see like financial capital as one, and then like industrial, so like different sections of like...
Yeah, or insurance. Good. We're witnessing a very good case of this in the U.S. right now. A national health program that controls health costs would be good for capitalism. It wouldn't be bad for capitalism. It would make American capitalism have a better competitive position in the world. It would help stabilize a source of considerable weakness in labor markets that's caused by the dependence of workers on particular employers, so that reduces mobility between jobs in a way that's bad for labor markets. You know, capitalism, American capitalism would work better if it had a national health program. But the insurance companies block it, and the pharmaceutical companies block it. They block it because it's not good for them. They're not thinking what's good for American capitalism, they're thinking what's good for them. Now, American capitalism is in a peculiarly privileged position because of its global situation, that these particularistic interests can block policy without it creating complete havoc with the system. But if we were less able to borrow from the rest of the world and depended more on the robustness of our own accumulation process domestically, you know, this would be a really major catastrophe. You really wouldn't. And I think if the American economy wasn't privileged in the world as a whole, I think the insurance companies would lose this battle quickly. It's only they're essentially, indirectly, they're being subsidized by Chinese sovereign wealth funds that are buying American bonds. That's what enables the American economy to act as if it doesn't have to worry so much about the domestic conditions for accumulation. Somebody here. Yeah.
I was going to kind of ask a similar question. These are general, one example of this might be the restaurant industry's resistance to government imposed standards on food quality and advertising, things like that.
Well,
it's less market related.
It's always going to be the case that individual capitalists are going to lobby for their own interests. That's always true. You know, in a liberal democracy, everywhere, any interest group is going to lobby because they can gain things for their own interests. And they're going to lobby against regulations which will harm their own particular interests. Now, some of those regulations are not particularly important for the reproduction of capitalism as a whole. They're just solving particular problems. So I would say things like rules that fast food restaurants have to post the calories and fat content of their food. That would be a good thing for people. It's, you know, improves the information transparency of the market and enables people to make more informed choices. But it's not the sort of thing which the stability of American capitalism depends upon. On the other hand, things like regulating financial institutions, regulating banks and insurance markets and housing markets, regulating information technologies and copyright and patents, I mean, all of these things do bear on the stability and robustness of accumulation as a whole. And the insurance, health insurance case certainly does. And these are instances where the state needs a fair amount of autonomy from these individual pressures in order to impose regulations that would act in this more broad and general interest. And the American state at the moment is in a particular period of history where it seems to lack that kind of autonomy. The American national state has been sufficiently colonized by particularistic interests in various ways that it does not seem to have the capacity to act decisively in the interests of capital as a whole to stabilize the system in, under new conditions of accumulation.
I was just wondering, maybe this is an aspect that we can cover the third one, may have mentioned, but in terms of the capitalist state or the nature of a capitalist state, in terms of just part of the issue here that's coming up with the healthcare bill is campaign finance, and not necessarily the relationship between state and capitalist accumulation, but the relationship between individual political personalities or individuals that operate within the state and their relationship to capitalist accumulation in terms of campaign finance. Is that something that came into the conversation at all?
Yeah, so
for Therborn's analysis or...
So how parties get their resources will vary. And some ways that parties get their resources make them particularly dependent on particular contributors. And other ways, public financing of various sorts, or rules which restrict the nature of campaigning, can make parties more autonomous from particular sources of funding. And therefore... less manipulated instruments of, for example, the insurance sector or finance capital. The American party system is the one that is most heavily financed by very large contributors. That's sort of characteristic of American party politics and electoral politics. So it's often been argued that in American politics, more than in Europe, in at least some or most European contexts, we've moved to a $1 one vote over a one person one vote system, which means that particularistic interests can manipulate the political system via the electoral system to a greater extent here than in other countries. Now, Terborn, I think he does. I don't remember how much he discusses political parties and their structure and how they relate to legislatures. I think he does talk about the distinctive form of the capitalist party at some point in that book, but I don't remember exactly that part of the discussion. You know how much that's explicit in his discussion. But one would, you know, in the Terborn type discussion, you would want to to say that we can imagine the way parties would be organized under socialist democratic conditions versus capitalist democratic conditions. And the key issue would be the extent to which they're deeply and organically connected to social movements and voluntary associations of ordinary citizens, as opposed to connected to sources of economic power. That is, in a socialist democratic system, there would be a much greater barrier between whatever economic power existed and the exercise of democratic power. Whereas in a capitalist system, that barrier is very weak. And that's separate from among capitalist economic, capitalist political party systems. Do some of them enable parties to act in more general interests versus particularistic interests of capital itself? Are some parties able to aggregate the interests of capitalists into a more coherent form, as opposed to simply having particular politicians being the tools of particular capitalist interests?
I was just thinking that it might be, with Aka's argument here, I was thinking that it might be useful to make it a little bit more specific. You know, like, I wonder, in thesis one, I wonder exactly, like, what he means by how capitalism is going to eat itself. You know, it might be useful to understand that specific, the specific way capitalism would eat itself, so that we can then understand the bureaucracy that is then put in place and then and its contradictions.
So, you know, the episodes we've been just through, I think, are very illustrative of the sort of problem that Offie would be identifying. If unregulated and not governed by system-reproducing principles, capitalist financial markets will engage in highly speculative schemes which create asset bubbles, which create extreme cycles of boom and bust. So extreme cycles of boom and bust are highly destabilizing, not just to the lives of people, which is bad enough, but it means a huge amount of extra destruction of wealth and disruption of the capital accumulation process. That would be the case if you had a regulatory system in place which could identify asset bubbles early on and put dampers on them. So the regulation of the financial system would be kind of the simplest case. Environmental regulation would be another. Unregulated capitalism will create gigantic negative externalities in the environment, not just long-term ones of the form of global warming, but short-term ones that would be environmentally destructive in ways that would be destabilizing of capitalism. And one could proliferate the examples. Probably the financial system is the best one because of the way that creates systemic risk for all capitalists, as opposed to just harms in the lives of people. The stability of capitalism as a system depends more on the stability of the conditions for accumulation of capital than it does on its welfare for the lives of people. Although, of course, politically that can matter a lot as well for the problem of political disruption of capitalism. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, if you're going to have a regulatory system of finance capital that's going to be effective, Offie's argument is it has to have real autonomy. You know, you have to empower that apparatus to be able to impose rules that the individual capitalists who are affected by those rules might not like. They're going to piss and moan about it because it does interfere with their ability to maximize their own profits. But it does so in order to stabilize the system as a whole. But the reason why this is contradictory is captured by what can be called the Frankenstein problem. The state needs a capacity to intervene pervasively, but it has to do so in a way that abstains from undermining accumulation, right? So you have to create a state that has enough autonomy to intervene in order to stabilize accumulation, but it has to refrain from using that power in ways that might contradict the interests of capital. And there, that's the problem. In order to create an apparatus that has autonomy and power to intervene, it must be able to have a capacity to do so destructively. The fantasy would be you'd create an autonomous power that could only intervene benevolently. The problem is, if you create that degree of autonomy and power to intervene, it also would have the power to intervene destructively. Now, that can either be because it can make unbelievably stupid mistakes. So the capacity to intervene destructively doesn't mean malevolently. It doesn't mean that its capacity to intervene destructively would be for destructive purposes. But you have to create a state that has the capacity to do real damage if it's going to have the capacity to regulate for good purposes.
We're talking about the Fed, basically.
The Fed would be an example, yeah. But it would be true for environmental regulation as well. That is, we need very strong environmental regulation in order to prevent global warming. But if you gave the state the capacity for that kind of regulation, it could do things that would also damage accumulation. And that's the Frankenstein problem, that you want to have an autonomous state to do all these things, but you also want it to be consistently subordinated to the requirements of accumulation. But if it's subordinated to the requirements of accumulation, it can't be autonomous enough to actually regulate accumulation. If it's not subordinated to accumulation, in the sense of directly subordinated, it can do damage to accumulation. I think there really is no solution to this problem, no stable solution. There's no stable equilibrium. You know, the fantasy here again is that if you design the institutions just right, they would always be able to avoid doing serious damage and would always be able to create the regulations which would effectively regulate accumulation. I don't think that's possible.